All right, it's good to be here back in Chicago. I've been here 100 times, and like Pauline said, I studied in Milwaukee, so it's kind of a suburb. And it's good to be back in the, to be here in a post-polar vortex event. So we're all kind of warming up and coming back to normal. And I've, you know, you've heard, many of you have heard me speak many times before. I was in Seattle a few days ago, and a fellow said to me, "I've heard you speak for 20 years now." You know, okay. And he said, "To your credit, Jeff, you vary your presentation. So thank you for that." So I promise tonight I'm going to vary my presentation, because I really have a message and a kind of a program, a plan, that I think has been missing for many years. You know, ICAD, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition that I belong to, has always been a political organization. We fight house demolitions, of course. We fight the occupation. But in the end, there has to be a political solution, a resolution to the situation. We can't stay at the level of protest and resistance and critiquing all the time. Well, until maybe 10 years ago, most of us in the Israeli peace camp, together with the Palestinians, were pursuing the two-state solution. That was the agreed-upon political solution. In other words, if it was good enough for Arafat, it's good enough for me. It wasn't fair, it wasn't just, but it was the international community, including the Palestinians, agreed to it. But as we'll see tonight, and I think as most of us that have any connection to this issue, and probably everybody that's been there, as we all know, the two-state solution is gone and dead and over. And in a sense, we're floundering today, I think, groups here and groups abroad, because we don't have an end game. You can't be in a political struggle without an end game. And of course, the end game has to come from the Palestinians themselves. Palestinians, supported by critical Israelis, have to give the leadership and direction for all of you to follow. Obviously, you're not going to liberate Palestine from Chicago. So we need you in order to mobilize, including changing your government's policies. But you certainly need us in order to know where to go, what the ask is, what the program is. So tonight, you know, so I've been sitting with a group. I'm a part of a group of about a core group of about 50 Palestinians and maybe 15 or so Israeli Jews. You have a program, it was passed out, or most of you have the program, that I'm going to talk about tonight, a 10-point political program. It has to be fleshed out, but I think it's a very good approach to resolving this whole situation. And on the back are the names of about, at the time we printed that, about 140 Palestinians and Israelis that had endorsed it. We're looking for more endorsees all the time in order to, if we can show you that we represent a meaningful voice, a meaningful alternative voice, a political voice, then I think we're getting to a point where we can begin to expect your organizations, local, but also the U.S. campaign and JVP and Sabil and the other organizations to endorse our program as well. Only when we all get on board with a political solution, an end game, that will bring us a genuinely just resolution to this issue, you know, are we actually going to end this thing? And so that's really what I want to try to present you tonight is this program and this line of thought that rests on a certain analysis that I think is important as well. And I want to I want to acknowledge the presence tonight of Ahmed Abu Artema from Gaza, who's here, who was brought. A journalist and a writer from Gaza who was, I don't know if he was brought by the AFSC, but he's, the AFSC is sponsoring with Jennifer, being sponsoring a three-week a lecture tour for him around the country, and then he's going back to Gaza. So Ahmed is a part of our group, signed on to our program, and I just want to acknowledge that you're here tonight. Okay, so we can begin with the question. You know, it's a question that we should ask, in a sense. Why should we care about the Palestinian issue so much? I mean, why are we here? There's 1,000 different issues in the world and conflicts. And some of them are, in a sense, worse than this one. I think of the Congo, for example, where the scale of violence is much greater. Certainly, what motivates many of us, as it should, is concern for the Palestinian people. You know, their human rights, their suffering, bringing justice to the Palestinians. I think what brings it home to many of us, of course, is that this isn't taking place in the Holy Land. So certainly if you're a Christian, you know, that means something. The Bethlehem is a city under siege. That the Christian Palestinians have been largely either driven out or in a sense induced to leave the country. Only 1.4% of the Palestinians in the occupied territories are today Christians. They're almost gone, and they were the middle classes and the backbone, in some ways, the economic backbone of Palestinian society. And of course, the fact that Jews are involved, Israeli Jews are involved, and the Jewish community in general, also means something. You know, Jews that have been are sort of the ultimate victims of history, that all the persecution, ironically and tragically, turn into the new Afrikaners, into the oppressors with a terrible occupation of 50 years. But in fact, as I'll talk about, a settler colonial regime of more than a century over the Palestinians, with all the suffering that they're imposing on the Palestinians, also brings it home to us. You know, if you're Jewish, you're a part of this whole thing. When Netanyahu goes in front of the American Congress to speak, or the UN, he's attacking Gaza. He's doing what he's doing in the name of the Jewish people, not in the name of the Israeli people only. And the Jewish community never elected him. But until the Jewish community, of course, JVP has done this, if not now has done this, other groups, but until the federations and Hillel and the rabbis and the Jewish establishment doesn't say, no, you don't represent us, they really are complicit in this terrible tragedy that's been going on all these decades. So that's one level, of course. A second level is why we should be concerned, of course, has to do with the region itself. I mean, if this was merely a spat between two local groups, then it wouldn't be so significant. But as we know, this conflict disrupts and destabilizes the entire Middle East. It's not the only conflict. I don't mean that everything is caused by this, of course. But, you know, John Kerry, when he was Secretary of State, said appropriately that you can't resolve anything in the Middle East. And as a matter of fact, McChrystal and Petraeus said the same thing from a military point of view. You're not going to bring stability and conflicts, bring democracy, development to the entire Middle East without ending the Israel-Palestine conflict. It's not a sufficient it's not sufficient to end everything, but it's necessary. You can't bypass it. So that a lot of the, without getting to details, a lot of the instability and the conflicts and the polarization and the militarization that's taking place in the Middle East has to do either directly or indirectly with the Israel-Palestine conflict. But there's another layer, and this is what my book is about, A War Against the People, my last book, and that is something that gets all of us involved, and that is that we all live, all of us in the world, in one capitalist system. And for the last 50 years or so, that system has been a very predatory and increasingly exclusionary system in which the rich are getting richer, and more people that used to be confined to the global south, now in the global north are becoming excluded. 80% of the people of this world live on less than $10 a day. Your own kids, I mean your kids here, do not have the prospect of achieving the standard of living that you have in terms of housing and jobs and security and so on. So that more and more people are being excluded by this system. And of course, the system is destroying the planet. Wars today are not wars of ideologies and countries and armies and battles. They're what are called resource wars. Just 3 days ago, Bolton, admitted that one reason why the United States intervened in Venezuela and tried to sponsor a coup there was for the oil. Venezuela has the highest oil reserves of any country. So these are resource wars against the people. Wars today are not against armies or other countries. Wars are against the people, whether they're people in the global south that happen to be inhabiting countries atop valuable resources, or people in the global north, like your kids, or certainly immigrants and poor people and minority groups and so on, that for different reasons have been excluded from the system and therefore are resisting or at least are restless. So the bottom line is that more and more capitalism, the global capitalism, neoliberal capitalism, the governments, but mainly the corporations that run the governments, have to become more repressive. People, whether it's in the global south or the global north, do not become marginal and impoverished voluntarily. In 1,000 different ways, we resist. So that there's a need to repress populations, or the entire global population, and what I call to pacify, a process of global pacification. Now, in this war against the people, which is fought not only by militaries, in fact, it's fought mainly not by militaries, but by homeland security forces, domestic security forces, and police. I mean, you all know in Chicago how your police are being militarized. if you take today the military and domestic security and policing all over the world, it amounts to a $2.5 trillion a year industry. And it's something we don't know much about. One reason why I wrote a book about something I know nothing about, which was a challenge. I was a steep learning curve. But I'm saying to myself, I'm an activist. I want to make the world a better place. I think of myself as politically attuned to what's happening. And I don't know anything about a $2.5 trillion a year industry that's got to have a tremendous impact in every sense. That's kind of a blind spot. Now, the issue is this, that in the war against the people, whether it's here or abroad, the United States has trouble dealing with it. The Pentagon, that has a $1 trillion a year budget, is producing weaponry that's suited to interstate warfare. The Pentagon produces weaponry like the F-35, for example, stealth bomber, that's good for fighting the Soviet Union. But it's not very good if you're trying to fight people in Kabul or Caracas or Chicago. So that the United States does not have an experience and doesn't have the weaponry and the tactics for war against the people. You know, we didn't do very well in Vietnam or Afghanistan or Iraq or other places. And Europe as well. I mean, Europe also has sophisticated armaments, but Europe hasn't fought colonial wars for the last 60, 70, 80 years. So in a global system where both each individual country, but also the system itself, needs to repress populations that are increasingly excluded, Israel becomes the go-to place. Now, I'm not saying again that Israel's the only actor by any means, but Israel's a country that is based on and continues to fight for 100 years a war against the Palestinian people. This is exactly the kind of warfare that Israel has really pioneered. And Israel has developed the weaponry, the tactics, what I call the technologies of repression, to pursue wars against the people. They also help produce, you know, conventional weapons for modern warfare. A lot of the cockpit of the F-35 is Israeli. The electronics and the avionics and so on. But Israel specializes exactly in the kinds of technologies to be used against people that the global capitalist system and its elites and its governments needs. And that creates then a quid pro quo. Israel delivers technologies of repression that are effective to governments and corporations, and in return, it's allowed to continue with its occupation. You know, one of the questions that nagged me all the time as I was sitting in front of bulldozers is, how does Israel get away with this? You know, talking about massive violations of human rights, you know, brutality in the light of day. This is happening in the southern border of Europe. It's not happening in some faraway place in a mountain. Violations and defiance of dozens of UN resolutions. How does Israel get away with something like this? And the answer, in my view, and it comes out of this book, is security politics. This quid pro quo that will provide you with the technologies to keep in power and repress and pacify your populations. In return, you give us a pass. And it's hard to understand the world without plugging this in. You know, we look at the world in a fairly common sense way. We have friends, and we have enemies, and we have allies. And that's the way the world kind of breaks. And they change occasionally, and you go back and forth. But when you put this security into the equation, really strange things happen. For example, we're used to thinking of Israel as being the best friend of the United States, probably in the world. You know, the Israeli prime minister every 2 years addresses Congress. And we share values and we love each other and we're so close friends and allies, and every presidential candidate will appear before AIPAC, except Bernie, at least. But all of a sudden you look at the map of Israel's security relationships. Israel's a country the size of New Jersey, I think with a smaller population than New Jersey, and it's the sixth largest arms exporter in the world. All of a sudden you see, look, Israel is very close to the U.S., but look what happens. Israel becomes the number two arms supplier to China. Whoa. I mean, China is kind of the arch rival of the U.S. The American Navy is moving its whole sixth fleet into the South Pacific to contain China. And our friend Bolton, John Bolton, look it up in the Haaretz, John Bolton was in Israel last week, and he said, if Trump finds out that Israel has such a close relationship in military and technology to China, he's really going to be upset. So luckily, he'll probably never find out. You know, Israel's the number two arms supplier to India. This little country the size of New Jersey is the second largest arms supplier to the two of the largest militaries in the world. So when you begin, in other words, all I'm trying to say from all of this is that there's a global dimension to the Palestinian issue. I talk about global Palestine, that Israel's exporting the occupation. And in many ways, you might see this as the ultimate map of intersectionality. Because, you know, for all our identities and all, the intricacies of working together and everything else, we're all sharing the same system. We all have, no matter where we're coming from, we have the same, in a sense, enemy, you might say, which is this global system that's oppressing all of us. So that I think a focus on that aspect of it, you know, the trick is, look, we should be concerned with Palestinians. I mean, it's wonderful that people care about the human rights of another people far away. But my message is, this occupation is here, in Chicago, in your neighborhood. You know, when Israel attacks Gaza, you can't explain the massive attacks on Gaza from the actual military threats that the people of Gaza or Hamas pose to Israel. You know, you can't explain that. The only way to explain those attacks and the scale of those attacks is that Gaza is a laboratory. And the Gazans are guinea pigs for the development and perfection of weapon systems that are then exported. You could ask the question, why didn't Israel accept the two-state solution 30 years ago, in 1988, when Arafat offered it? Israel could have had 78% of the country, a Jewish state that they're so concerned about keeping, and peace for the last 30 years. Imagine how that might have impacted on the Middle East. It could have had all that at the price of giving up Tul Karm and Jericho and Khan al-Ahmar. You know, Gaza. Why didn't it grab that offer? In a sense, Zionism won, you might say, in 1988. And not only the Palestinians and the Arab League, but the entire world would have recognized Israel. Why? Because the occupation, there's two reasons. I'll get to the second one in a second. But we have to look at the occupation as a resource for Israel, not as a threat. You know, there aren't many countries that have millions of people that they can actually experiment on. I know it's hard to say this, but it's the case, and I document it in the book. This is Israel's export. This is its economy. But at the same time, it also explains its political clout. You know, and sometimes I say that Israel without the occupation would be New Zealand. You know, it'd be a nice little country that people would like to go visit. It would certainly not be the fourth largest nuclear power in the world, a sort of an associate member of NATO, a member of the OECD. None of that would be true if it didn't have the occupation, both economically and politically, as an export resource. So the occupation is here because, again, the people of Gaza aren't the end users. They're the guinea pigs. They're the ones that you perfect the weapons on. You're the customers. You're at the receiving end. Because Israel exports these technologies to your police forces, to your armies, right, to your security forces. So that in a sense, it's not the Gazans, it's the Chicagoans who are at the receiving end of this. And, you know, as your military, security forces, police forces are being Israelized, and JVP, for example, has a whole program called Deadly Exchange, which is trying to document how Israel trains, not only trains American police, but also restructures the departments in ways that are repressive. I won't get into that. As your police forces are being Israelized, you're being Palestinianized. So in a sense, there's a very real sense here in which you can see yourselves as Palestinians and not only, you know, be in sympathy, identify with Palestinians. So on all kinds of levels, this is a global conflict or a global issue that we have to resolve. So you know, going back to Palestine itself, this is a family whose home has been demolished 6 times. Israel's demolished 55,000 Palestinian homes in the occupied territory since 1967. And going back to this level, we can ask the question, okay, how can we resolve this then? What is the way out, especially if the two-state solution is dead? Well, we have to begin not with a solution. We have to begin with an analysis. Because if you don't understand what's happening and have the right vocabulary, you're not going to get to the right conclusions. And the problem is we see this as a conflict. We talk about the Israel-Palestine conflict or the Israel-Arab conflict, and it's not a conflict. It's not a conflict because a conflict has two sides. A conflict is roughly symmetrical. You have two sides. They disagree about something. And the way to resolve a conflict is you bring the sides together. They negotiate. They come up with some kind of compromise, and then they make peace, and that ends it. But here there aren't sides. This is, we're talking about with Zionism and Israel, is a unilateral settler colonial process. Settler colonialism doesn't have sides. The United States is a settler colonial country, of course. You know, so when the American settlers came in, they weren't negotiating with the Native Americans. They weren't asking permissions. They weren't saying we're coming to somebody else's country. On the contrary, and Pauline just gave me tonight an article from the Catholic Church about the principle of discovery. The principle of discovery, where the Catholic Church, already around the time of Columbus, has a doctrine that any time Catholics get to another country, especially in the New World, they claim it for the church or claim it for themselves, and the indigenous have no rights. And this is what's common to settler colonialism. Every settler colonial movement makes up a narrative that entitles it to the land, the settlers to the land, and takes away any entitlement of the indigenous population. Usually God is involved. You know, God gave South Africa to the white man. That's the Dutch Reformed Church. In the United States, of course, God shed his grace on thee and manifest destiny and all of that. With John Wayne adding in his day that, you know, the Indians just never developed the place. So, you know, they had no... And you hear that also about Palestinians. It's we Israeli Jews that have made the desert bloom. They left it barren, right? That's also part of it. Sometimes it doesn't have to do with God. The French came in with the idea of civilization. We have to civilize the savages. Whatever your narrative is, settlers have the right to take the land. It belongs to them in one way or another. So there is no other side. You know, sides mean that at least I recognize there's another side and I have to deal with it. In settler colonialism, there's no other side. There's indigenous that have to be pushed aside sometimes, but it's a unilateral process. So it's not a conflict, it's a settler colonial process. And that's important because, for example, we talk about the occupation. I mean, one of our great slogans is end the occupation. That's one of the elements of BDS. I would argue there is no occupation. Because occupation implies somehow an external territory. There's a territory here that is not a part of Israel. That somehow Israel accepts that it's not a part of Israel, that can be detached and become a Palestinian state. And so, you know, it's another territory. That's not the case. Zionism as a settler colonial movement 125 years ago had at its goal the conquest, and that was a word that was used because Joshua used the same word, the conquest of the land of Israel, the whole land of Israel, not 78% of it. There was no green line in the Zionist program. It was to take the land of Israel. And if I would put the whole Zionist movement into one term, it's not a term we use often, but it's a very important term, it would be Judaization. We're Judaizing the country. And it's a term that the Israeli government uses officially. The official Israeli policy is we're Judaizing the Galilee. We're Judaizing Jerusalem. And the Zionist movement's overall goal was to Judaize the land of Israel. In other words, to transform an Arab country into a Jewish country. To transform Palestine into the land of Israel. Not part of Palestine, not part of the land of Israel, the land of Israel. As a matter of fact, Begin's party, the Herut, Jabotinsky and Begin, that lead into the Likud of today, always have had the principle that Western Jordan is also a part of the land of Israel. This is where the tribe of Manasseh settled in the Bible. So that by ending our claim at the Jordan River, we've already given up. We've already compromised and given up a good part of the land of Israel. So that the idea then is, this is our country exclusively. And the exclusivity is important. And this, you know, there's three, I don't want to get too much into this, but it's important because it leads us to a particular solution. If you understand what Zionism is all about, you understand that the two-state solution was never in the cards. You know, and it allows us to really read the political situation correctly. So Zionism comes out of three roots. One, of course, is the Old Testament, which is a genocidal book of conquest of one people that claim the entire country, and everybody else are strangers. If you ever read the book of Joshua, you know where ISIS comes from. It's a pretty tough book, not only Joshua. So that's a part of it. That's what gives entitlement. The whole idea also, as you know, that we're coming back, that the Romans conquered the land of Israel, Judea, exiled the Jews, and now after 2,000 years coming back. Not true. Not true. It's absolutely a made-up narrative. And I can tell you the man that made it up, Ben-Zion Dinur, who was the first educational minister of Israel, made it up. There is no evidence of any reputable historian, including Israeli historians, that any exile ever took place after the Roman conquest. Romans did not exile people. They sold slaves. I mean, some people were sold as slaves. There was no exile. And not only that, but the Jewish community of Palestine flourished in the century after the Roman revolt, after the revolt against the Romans. You had the Babylonian Talmud, you had Yavne, you had all these Talmudic centers that emerged in Palestine at that time. So it's a completely made-up story of return. So like I said, every settler colonial movement makes up a story that gives it entitlement. The second element of Zionism is Eastern European nationalism. You know, and you know, Israel tries to present itself as the only democracy in the Middle East. And if you go there, it looks very European. Most of the people look whitish. It has a European standard of living, and so on. People know English. But in fact, Zionism comes out of Eastern and Central Europe. Germany, you know, before World War II, Poland, Hungary, and especially Russia. And, you know, American and Western European nationalism of the 19th century is what we might call a civil nationalism. That's what you know. The idea that a country belongs to its citizens. That's the concept in the West. In Central and Eastern Europe, where Zionism came from, this is where probably 90% of the Jews lived. It was a kind of a tribal nationalism, where a country belonged to one particular group. Russia belonged to the Russians. Until today, it's like that. Russia belongs to the Russians. So when you had the Soviet Union and they took the Ukraine, they Russified the Ukraine. The Ukrainians didn't become Russians. You had to send, that's some of the basis of the conflict today. You sent a Russian population in to Russify it. If you look at how Poland and Hungary today are closed against any kind of accepting of immigrants and asylum seekers that Europe, the EU, is trying to impose on them, you can see the xenophobia. These countries are called ethnocracies, as opposed to a democracy that belongs to all its citizens. I'm not pretending that in a democracy you don't have racism and discrimination, but the principle is equality, equal rights for citizens of the country. In Eastern and Central Europe, an ethnocracy meant a population belonged to one group exclusively, and that was the basis of Zionism. You have to look at the Israeli flag, and you can see that. So the idea is, you know, transposed from Russia, the idea is that this country belongs, the land of Israel belongs exclusively to the Jewish people. So this was another issue. Not only, and then the third, of course, the third element was settler colonialism. So from each of those sources, whether it's the Bible or Eastern European ethnocracy or settler colonialism, you had no concept of another side, of an indigenous population that had any kind of rights. And the process then was unilateral and complete. So in 1967, Israel didn't conquer the West Bank. Israel simply completed its century-long process of conquering the West Bank, but not as an external part of the country, as an integral part, as Judea and Samaria. Israel never, ever, ever admitted to an occupation. It doesn't accept that term. It doesn't accept Israel as a signatory to the Fourth Geneva Convention that protects people living under occupation, but it says it doesn't apply because there is no occupation. You can't occupy your own country. And so what I'm trying to suggest here is that the two-state solution, I mean, it is an occupation. The international community says it's an occupation. International law says it's an occupation. The International Court of Justice in The Hague says it's an occupation. The Palestinians certainly know it's an occupation. But from the Israeli point of view, and that's the view that counts, because Israel gets away with it. Nobody is going to force Israel to abide by international law or get out of the occupied territory. So it's really the Israeli settler colonial perspective that we have to understand to figure out how to get out of this mess. In that perspective, there is no occupation. This is all the land of Israel. And we've simply Judaized the last piece of the land of Israel, which is Judea and Samaria, which is not only isn't it external, But it's the very heart of the land of Israel. This is where the biblical events took place, not in Tel Aviv. So that's the concept. And in case you still didn't get the message, Israel imposed a matrix of control over the occupied territory, what we call facts on the ground, that are so massive and so permanent and so irreversible that it's a fait accompli. Doesn't matter if the international community thinks it's an occupied territory, it's already been incorporated into Israel. Again, I would argue there is no more occupation. Occupation is defined in international law as a temporary military situation. Well, after 50 years, you have about 800,000 Israelis living in the Palestinian areas, in 200 settlements, all these blue blotches and these red areas where the settlements are being consolidated into major urban areas. The Palestinians, now we have to remember, this is also crucial, the Palestinians are the majority in this country today. If we take this country between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River as one country, the Palestinians are already the majority before any refugees return. And yet, 95% of the Palestinians are locked into 40% of the occupied territory. In other words, Gaza, which is a cage, or what we call areas A and B, these darker brown areas and these lighter beige areas, which together make up 40% of the occupied territory. Just to put it in a comparative perspective, the occupied territory is a territory about the size of Rhode Island, which isn't the largest state in the Union. So now you have 95% of the Palestinians confined to 40% of Rhode Island. And then that is shattered into about 164 islands. Within the 40% of Rhode Island, and then put into those little islands almost 6 million people. And you get the idea of the conditions in the occupied territory. So that this is really an apartheid situation. And in fact, what we're arguing is this. The two-state solution is gone or never was. Even though the Palestinians offered it to Israel, and it's still on the table. I mean, tomorrow morning Abu Mazen would sign off on it if Israel agreed. But Israel said no. This is crucial to understand, because one of the ways Israel gets away with it is that Israel casts itself as the victim. You know, we're the ones that are the victims. So that... And that's a perfect place to be, because if you can be a victim, you can't be held accountable in international law or in the court of public opinion. So what we're saying is Israel eliminated the two-state solution. Okay, which means then that Israel has already created a single state. There already is one state between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River. That argument is over. Two states or one state. There is one de facto state. In other words, in this entire country, you can only get in through Israeli border controls. There's only one effective government, and it's not the PA. There's only one army, obviously, one electrical system, one water system, one highway system, one currency. By any measure, this is already one country. But it's an apartheid country, because you've got one ruling government, but three legal regimes. You've got one regime for Israeli Jews who are citizens. You have a second legal regime for Palestinian citizens of Israel who do not have equal rights to Jews. And you have a third legal regime for Palestinian non-citizens of Israel in the occupied territory. That's apartheid. So, if the two-state solution is gone, and apartheid, I'm going to assume in this church, is not acceptable to any of us, it seems to us the only way out, almost mathematically, is to transform the one apartheid regime that Israel created into a democratic state of equal rights for all its citizens. Which shouldn't be such a shocking idea for Americans. You know, a democracy. All right, let me just take another couple minutes. I don't want to go on too long, which I have. Let me just take another couple minutes, though, to flesh that out. The one state is in the air. I mean, it's clear most people know the two-state is gone. But it's never been fleshed out. And that's why we've tried to come into this breach and begin to flesh out what does it exactly mean? How would it work? What would it look like? And there's two parts of this one-state solution. Decolonization, because if this is a settler colonial regime, you've got to decolonize. It isn't some practical agreement that the line goes here and you do territorial swaps and you share this and do that and it's all over. You've got to get to the deep fundamental issues of colonialism, settler colonialism. And then you have to say, well, how do we replace that? What do we replace it with? I just want to give you four points to our 10-point program. The first one is we're talking about a single constitutional democracy. One country, and this is the great revolution, of course, one country that belongs to all its citizens, which sounds almost routine to you, but this is a revolution because it's changing an ethnocracy into a democracy. You know, it's saying there is a concept of citizen, and everybody is a citizen. Citizen becomes the way you structure and organize the society. And that's really crucial, and I'll explain in a minute. The second point, and that's the point that Ahmed glommed onto immediately, forget the other nine, is the right of return. The right of return of Palestinian refugees is absolute. It's not, you're not going to get anywhere with Palestinians without the right of return of Palestinians and their descendants. And it makes sense, because refugees are a part of your citizenry. That's why that concept is so important. They're not external. They might have fled, they might have been driven out, but they haven't given up their belonging, their membership in the citizenry. So as you begin to put together a state again based on citizens, you have to bring back any refugee that wants to come back. Now, if a refugee chooses not to and become a citizen of another country, that's fine. But the refugee has a right to choose because the refugee has never given up his or her citizenship or a part of the citizenry. And, of course, we have to help them reintegrate into the country. Individual rights. This I don't have to explain. We're talking about a constitutional democracy, a liberal democracy, in which everybody has equal rights. One parliament, one citizenry, one vote, no separation, no none of those that monkey business, just like here. A liberal democracy of equal individual rights for everyone. But there's one more point that's important and that's more difficult. And that is, you know, the United States is unique. Canada, the United States, some of the countries in the New World, Australia and so on, because leaving the Native Americans aside, which I don't really mean, but you know what I mean. The country was based on the idea of, I mean, not just Native Americans, but black Americans and slaves and women, leaving a lot of groups aside. the concept was citizenship. And the citizenship is is for everyone once you manage to join the society. In the Middle East, like most of the world, national groups, ethnic groups, religious groups, clans, tribes have preceded the state. The state is a brand new idea. Israel only became a state in 1948. Jordan in 1946. So these are new ideas. So the state has to find a way to fit onto the ethnic, national, religious landscape of the country. In other words, we're not talking about Kansas, just a bunch of voters. But we're talking about a country that already has very deep identities and communities and collectives. So to recognize that, we're saying we acknowledge the collective rights of all the groups in the country, whether they're national, ethnic, religious, class, gender, whatever the basis of your identity is, of your collective, that's fine. It's okay. Within a democratic state, you can have that space. You don't say that in the U.S. It's sort of implied, but you have to say it in this kind of a situation because there's so much history and conflict and competition. But there's also another reason why you have to say that, and that is that the Israelis are going to be the minority in this country, and they have a great fear that we have to address, and that is, you know, they're not stupid, the Israelis. What's going to prevent the Palestinian majority from doing to us what we do to them? The tyranny of the majority. So that the idea of collective rights means that under the Constitution, there'll be a Constitution, the parliament will not have the authority to discriminate against any community. That's it. It's a safety net. You're safe. You're okay. You can have your community. Now let's get on with living together. The last point I want to mention has to do with what do we replace this all with? A post-colonial element. And that is, now we're in a position, we've dismantled the structures of domination. Now we're in a position to create a new civil society. One in which we can all live together. There'll be civil marriage that you don't have today in Israel-Palestine. There'll be schools that are integrated. You can live wherever you want to live in the country, an integrated economy. So over time, people will begin to live together and create a new civil society. I want to give you one tiny example of what I mean, just from the daily experience of living together. And it's going to take time. You know, in the rest of the world, football does not mean NFL. Football is what you would call soccer. And the International Football Association is known as FIFA. And in the FIFA standings, the Palestinian national football team has a higher ranking than the Israeli national football team. Well, getting into the World Cup is a huge thing. I mean, I don't know if you picked it up, but Croatia was discovered this year during the World Cup. You know, I mean, it's like the Super Bowl times 100. So that if together, imagine a Palestinian-Israeli football team gets into the World Cup. I mean, seriously, what kind of a nation-building kind of common experience that would be? So that's what we really have in mind. So just to summarize, we're talking about. Well, let's just look at this side. In other words, this is how we would depict it. One, multicultural democracy, in which you have a common civil society. Now, the civil society, not everybody's going to jump into that at the beginning. You know, Palestinians would resist some of them, especially refugees. They come back, have no concept of what a civil society means. You've got Israelis also, especially religious ones maybe that wouldn't. It's okay. You have your space to gradually begin to... But the idea that young people, more secular people, more middle class people would begin to come together and this civil society begins to enlarge is really the key to our approach. And again, you have space then for your collective identities. And what's interesting to note is that this isn't only a country of Palestinian Arabs and Israeli Jews. We have 40,000 African asylum seekers in the country that Israel can't get rid of because of international laws protecting asylum seekers that are the nucleus of a major community in the country. You've got children of about 350,000 foreign workers that are, you know, they leave sometimes the foreign workers, but they don't all leave. And sometimes they leave kids and they leave relationships. That's another community. You've got 150,000 to 200,000 Russian citizens of Israel who are not Jewish and don't want to be Jewish. They call themselves ethnic Russians. So the country is much more diverse than simply the two national groups we've been talking about. So this is really the idea. And I will talk during the questions and answers, if you want to, by how we get there. So that's sort of the idea, and I think we have time for discussion.
Okay. Well, then you have questions.
Could you talk a little bit about your organization?
Well, our organization is the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. We started, as Pauline mentioned, in 1997. As the Oslo peace process was in a process of collapse, we in the Israeli peace movement felt we had to re-engage in resisting the occupation that was coming back. You know, we also invested hopes that Oslo might move something, but we understood that it wasn't going to move ahead. After Rabin's assassination, Netanyahu gets elected the first time, it's clear that that was the end. But you know, occupation is a big kind of abstract idea for Israelis as well as for people abroad. So we decided to focus on the issue of house demolitions, which is one of the most painful aspects of the occupation. Again, when we started in 1997, 9,000 Palestinian homes had been demolished. Now, 20 years later, we're up to 55,000 Palestinian homes that have been demolished. So you can imagine the impact that has on Palestinian society. And what's important is they're not demolished for security reasons. I mean, the knee-jerk reaction is, well, these must be houses of terrorists. And therefore, Israel has the right for security to... No. In only 1% of the cases does this have anything to do with security. This is completely a proactive... basically, Israel simply prevents Palestinians from building houses for the last 50 years. And if you have children, your children have children, you have to live somewhere, and you're not allowed to build a new home. So that it induces emigration, and it gets people off their land and into these areas A and B, and Gaza that I mentioned. So that it's a form of ethnic cleansing. And so we, you know, fight it on the ground, we resist. We also raise money, and that's why the ambassador's going around, because we only get money from the people. We don't get money from governments or foundations, because we're political. And we've built 200 homes over the last 20 years. Now, you might say 200 homes out of 55,000 is kind of meaningless, but if you think of it as 200 joint acts of resistance, because it's illegal to rebuild homes, joint acts of resistance of Palestinians and Israelis together, that really is a meaningful form of resistance. And then what we do, because we know the lay of the land, we kind of bridge. We know Palestinians, and often I go speak on tours with Palestinians, but we know Palestinians and their reality, but we also know Israel and its reality and its government. We're able then to translate what we know, the authority of what we're saying coming from us being there on the ground. But being able to understand what's going on and then translating that into maps and presentations and bringing that reality forward into the political arena. So that's really what ICAT has been all about.
What you're talking about sounds, it makes a lot of sense.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you get there? Because the subjective conditions are such that nobody in Israel,
that's
very
right.
Few people did it.
Well, that's true. I mean, certainly, as I've mentioned, the Israelis want one state. They see this as a land of Israel, and they've acted to make it one state. But the Palestinians as well certainly have a national liberation movement. The goal of the PLO was a Palestinian state. To their credit, although Edward Said saw it as kind of a giving in, they agreed to the two-state solution. It's almost inconceivable that a colonized people gives up 78% of its country for peace to a colonial power. I mean, that's never happened before. And of course, instead of getting credit for that, the Palestinians have been demonized as being intractable and terrorists and all of that. So, it's true that that's what both people would prefer. Some kind of the Israelis want a state without Palestinians. The Palestinians want a state of their own, but they're much more willing to be inclusive. But that's simply not the reality today that can happen. There can't be a settler colonial state, obviously. And the Palestinians don't have the strength to push Israel out of the country. And that's not their agenda, but even to push them out of the 22% and get a small state. I think it's so that we're left with this dilemma of both peoples have to go over this hump, and it's not an easy hump. There can't be a Jewish state anymore, but there also can't be a Palestinian state anymore. Now, once you get over that, in my view, you have a win-win situation here. Peoples live in the country flourishes, they live together. You also keep your collective identity. Nobody's going to close the Hebrew University. Nobody's going to prevent you from speaking your language, and so on. So I really don't see a downside to our program. I mean, I'm happy to hear if somebody does, except for the fact that, yes, there isn't going to be a Palestinian state and there isn't going to be an Israeli state. That seems to me just obvious given the political context. And now moving on, I think we've begun to outline a solution that is really a win-win solution for everyone, inclusive.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Rose from Siraj. I'm wondering how you have envisioned the education system. I know the Palestinian system is quite different, and then incorporating both languages.
Look, we haven't fleshed out everything. We're just at the beginning. We have a 10-point program. It's taken us about a year and a half to put together. And we have ongoing meetings within our societies to begin to flesh it out much more. So I can't get into too much detail. But I think broadly I would say that you'd have a single educational system, a public school system for everyone. But that wouldn't rule out, having a school for your religious school or a school for your community as well. I haven't really, like you have in this country in a sense. But the thrust of what we're suggesting is the creation of a new integrated civil society. And I have to say, people say, well, they're enemies. How could they live together? They'll kill each other, bloodbath. That was a big word in South Africa before the end of apartheid. That didn't happen. But think about it. Even under the terrible conditions of occupation, we're living together in a fairly, I can't say a normal way, but there is coexistence today. Certainly Palestinians that are citizens of Israel, second class as they are, we're not at each other's throats. It's functioning, and even with the occupied territory. 30 years ago, before Israel closed the territories to Palestinian laborers, 120,000 Palestinians would come every day to work in Israel without any particular problems. So that I don't think, you know, I think in a sense coexistence is certainly possible. And in a weird kind of a way, we can even show that under the difficult conditions of today. So that I think the idea of a joint civil society is a very real possibility.
What would you call this new country?
that's an important question. I have a joke for it. That if you want to be inclusive, you could call it Palestine if you spelled Stein, S-T-E-I-N. That aside, we don't have a name. And that really shows why I mean that we have to create a new civil society. Before the end of apartheid, before the end, Mandela could say we're all South Africans. That's what the Freedom Charter said in 1955. We're all South Africans. We can't say that. We're not all really anything. And so I think over time, to tell you the truth, a name will have to emerge from the country as we begin to create a joint civil society. But that shows the degree to which there isn't an overarching national identity or institutions today. So we don't have a name today.
Hi, I'm Jeff. How do you deal with the economic issues? The Israelis will withhold the vast majority of the economic wealth.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in South Africa, we see that the white minority continues to dominate economically.
That's right.
So how do you deal with that question?
Well, the Palestinians are in a much better position than the blacks in South Africa. The Palestinian population is fairly well educated. If you take all the Palestinians in the world and all the Israeli Jews in the world, there are more Palestinian students in universities than there are Israelis. They have a fairly vibrant economy. It's suppressed. It's not able to function. If you aim them a level playing field, their economy is actually very strong. Shir Hever is an Israeli political economist who's written about this. He says actually the Israeli and Palestinian economies complement each other, whether it's agriculture or high tech. You know, I learn things as I travel. So here I was in Seattle, and you have Redmond, Washington, where Microsoft is located. The largest expat community in Redmond, Washington, are Indians from India. The second largest are Palestinians there. I mean, they have a very vibrant high-tech. I mean, many of you know Sam Bahur, who meets us. I mean, Sam is in the telecommunications industry there. It's there. It's like a jack-in-the-box that if it would only be allowed, I think the Palestinian economy would flourish. And there's one other thing we have to keep in mind, the Palestinian diaspora. Palestinians have a diaspora that's wealthy. I mean, it runs Latin America to some degree. It's wealthy. It's highly educated. No less so than the Jewish diaspora that kicked in when Israel, and until today for Israel. So I think Palestinians have resources, and they have a political culture that I believe with a level playing field, they could actually achieve parity within a fairly short period of time. So there, it's a completely different situation than you had in South Africa from that point of view.
My name is Cliff Brown. From what I've seen, there are signs at the West Bank that warn Israelis not to go in, that it's illegal, and that their lives are...
Areas A and B.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I've heard it said...
Or A, actually.
...that some Israelis say they want to kill us. My impression is that the Netanyahu government almost enjoys this, and they feed on it.
That's right.
How would you deal with the government having that point of view?
Well, that's the problem. The good news is that after all these years, The Palestinians don't hate Israelis. I don't think it's gotten to the level, I would say, maybe this is provocative, I would say that the Irish hate the British, you know, and the Poles hate the Germans or the Russians more than Palestinians hate Israelis. They're pissed off, they're angry, they're outraged, but it hasn't gotten to the hatred yet that would prevent. Is from the Israeli point of view, it's also not hatred. Israelis, if I can say this in a church, Israelis don't give a shit about Arabs. It's just a non-issue. They don't care. So it's sometimes, in some ways, it's worse than hatred because it's hard to, there's no emotion, but that's the way that is. But for the Palestinians, I think they're certainly willing to deal with Israelis. And so, it's still open-ended. It's still possible for us to find ways to live together. I think Netanyahu deliberately is trying to flame the hatred to a point where really any kind of peace and reconciliation is impossible. He's doing two things, and I think deliberately. He's threatening the Muslim holy places, especially Al-Aqsa Mosque, you know, sending the police in, sending settlers in. Gradually, Israelis are starting to encroach on the mosque, you know, the Haram al-Sharif, you know, the Temple Mount and so on. And there's even a proposal before the government to do to the Mosque of Omar what was done to the mosque in Hebron. And that is divide it and give part of it to Jews and part of it to Muslims. I mean, and this is something that not only generates hatred among Palestinians, but in the entire Muslim world. I mean, you have more demonstrations almost against Israeli threats to Al-Aqsa than you have from Indonesia, than you have locally. That's one thing. The second thing he's doing is attacking the kids. If you've noticed, and there's military court watch and Defense of Children International and Save the Children, other groups have documented this. Over the last 4 or 5 years, there's been a tremendous increase in attacks on children. Whether it's killing them, arresting them, you know, torturing them, harassing, you know. So, you know, it's a funny kind of a thing. Palestinians, I mean, you know, they can understand house demolitions, in a sense, let's say, or attacks on Gaza. All right, it's political. We know it helps in elections. We know we're victims of it. You know, but there's an explanation. But you go after my kids? Now that's crossing the red line. So I think in terms of threatening Muslim holy sites and going after kids, that's where Israel is trying to flame this hatred that would then prevent any kind of reconciliation. And I think that's a deliberate policy. It's true. But we haven't gotten there yet.
My name's Alice Faisal. You're talking about the diaspora and the right of return. The question is, if all of Palestinians...
There's about 5 to 7 million refugee, the refugee population.
5 million refugees come back to this country.
Right. No, actually, the UN, in its study, says that the land of Israel, Palestine, you know, between the Mediterranean and the Jordan River, could fairly easily handle 12 to 15 million people. You know, the Negev is largely empty. The Galilee is not so populated. Parts of the West Bank. There's space. And not only that, there's another interesting wrinkle to this. There's a Palestinian geographer named Salman Abu Sita who's done a lot of research on land. And he's found that 85% of the land taken from the Palestinians in 1948 is still available. Israel never built on it. It's either agricultural land or it's under national parks. So that, in fact, refugees wouldn't only be able to return, they can't return to their houses, of course, which in the most cases, have been demolished. Israel demolished more than 600 entire villages and towns and urban neighborhoods. But you could conceivably, as a refugee, come back to the area of the country that you came from. Our plan of reintegration is to build new modern communities, you know, to help these populations reintegrate into the country. So actually, the land issue is a doable issue. That's not one of the obstacles today.
If you had thoughts about the role of nonviolent direct action that would be appropriate for American citizens to think about in the short term, and what might be some thoughts for targets.
Well, I think, you know, doing a lot of actions already. I mean, I would suggest continuing to do what you do. BDS, Karen was telling me today about the Christmas carols you sing around Palestine at Christmas time. In Iowa, I just heard in Iowa, they're organizing, all the presidential candidates are coming to Iowa for the primaries. And they're organizing across the state to confront them about the issue of Palestine. So they got their schedules, they've got the whole state is organized, and they'll hit these people city after city after city as they go across Iowa. So there's already some very creative and very effective nonviolent actions that are being taken. But I think what we're missing today is that political end game. So what we have to do, this idea of going to your congressional representatives, that becomes the next step. And the problem is, of course, you can go to them, and you know, politicians, they'll say, what do you want? They don't want a lecture on human rights in Palestine. What do you want? And if we can't tell them what we want, they'll show us that, oh, we could always want that they demolish less houses and they occupy, you know, we have these, but, you know, what we have to all do is get behind a political end game. I think all our organizations have to do that, and then we begin to develop a concerted political campaign to change government policy. That's what happened in the anti-apartheid movement. Don't forget, the Reagan administration was, called Mandela a terrorist. They were against the anti-apartheid activities, just like today. And it was mainly churches, but certainly civil society that changed public opinion and changed corporate policy, where they started to pull out of South Africa. So that, I think, has to be the new front that we haven't developed enough, because until now we haven't had that end game. And all the different groups have to come together and begin to formulate a very effective strategy of changing government's positions in terms of advocating for a single state.
Hi, Jeff. My question is, I don't know how it is in the rest of the world or Israel, but here in America, we've gotten to the point where it's hard to discuss these things because it's either pro-Israel or anti-Semitism.
That's right.
If you try to discuss things with people, you know, we have two congresspeople now that are inundated with, you know, they've only been in less than a month in Congress, and every other day there's somebody calling them anti-Semitic.
That's right.
We're just discussing Palestine.
That's right.
How do we overcome that as a society?
Well, you know, there's a very concerted effort on the part of the Israeli government. The Israeli government about 10 years ago deliberately and in a meeting in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs invented what's called the new anti-Semitism. They invented it, and the new anti-Semitism says any criticism of Israel is anti-Semitism. Now, then it got academic conferences to talk about it, and now it's getting governments to adopt it. The British government adopted it. And the reason why there's such a virulent campaign against Jeremy Corbyn as an anti-Semite is because he refuses to allow the Labour Party to accept that definition. Because obviously it's intended to close all criticism of Israel. So we have to understand that this is a political maneuver. There's nothing in it that has any merit. On the contrary, there's a lot of Jews that are very upset about this, because what it does, there generally is anti-Semitism in the world as a form of racism. But what it does is it lets them off the hook. So you have all kinds of neo-Nazi groups. Richard Spencer said not long ago that Israel is the model of white supremacy that should be brought to the United States. So you have neo-Nazis that are pro-Israel, but they're certainly anti-Semitic, which is a threat to the Jewish community. Whereas you get Jews like Noam Chomsky, who are critical of Israel, who aren't allowed in because they're considered anti-Semitic. We have a joke, you know, in Israel that an anti-Semite used to be someone who hates Jews. Today, an anti-Semite is anybody who Jews hate. And so we have to call them on that and not give in. And I think the Jewish community is playing a very irresponsible role here, because Israel is really sacrificing the well-being of Jews for its own self-interests. You know, and the author of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was a French Jewish lawyer named René Cassin, who won the Nobel Peace Prize and so on. And he said, you know, he said that human rights is the answer to anti-Semitism. It's a form of racism, and it should be attacked. And so, you know, Israel should support human rights and part of that discourse. Because the minute you make Israel an exception, this anti-Semitism is taking out one form of racism as an exception, and now you can't criticize it and all that stuff. René Cassin asked the Jews, you know, we were persecuted because we were outside of the umbrella. We were outside of humanity. We were the exception. Human rights brought us back under the umbrella with everyone. Do you really want to step out again? I mean, that's the question for Israel and the organized Jewish community. Do you really want to step out and have Jews be the exception again and not be subordinate to human rights or international law or UN resolutions, and then any criticism of Israel being seen as illegitimate and a different form of racism than any other races? I mean, that creates a very dangerous, I think it puts Jews back in a very dangerous position. Israel's willing to do that for its own self-interest. It's really willing to sacrifice the Jewish people. I think it's one of the crimes.
First of all, you mentioned very in a qualified way that Israel had the opportunity to have a two-state solution 30 years ago if they had only accepted the offer. Of course, every time you have a conversation here, the narrative is exactly the opposite, that the Palestinians had an opportunity for a two-state solution 30 years ago, only that accepted. Can you please elaborate exactly how we can respond to that?
Right.
Secondly, with respect to Gaza, of course, we are told, and our congressmen and senators agree and believe it, that Israel is threatened, that we have, that they have to respond to Hamas. Help us with that as well.
Okay. For the first question, the issue is, you know, the whole idea that Israel made a generous offer to the Palestinians, especially Barak at Camp David, and the Palestinians have always rejected it. And they're the intractable ones, and we've tried to make peace, and they didn't agree, and all of that. Well, you know, that ignores, again, and that's why it's so important, I think, some of the work we do, it ignores the facts on the ground. You know, that, you know, even at the time when Barak made his so-called generous offer, that which is an urban myth. There never was a generous offer at Camp David. But even if he had, you know, at that time there were more than 400,000 Israeli settlers. And Barak is the one who developed this idea of settlement blocks. See, seven, these red areas, seven settlement blocks that permanently through massive urban development and the building, as you can see, of a whole matrix of Israeli highways, just incorporate Judea and Samaria, we don't say the West Bank in Israel, into Israel itself, and then create what Israel calls cantons. You see, cantons in between the settlement blocks, in between settlements, in between the highways, all these disconnected kind of a canton. And all this was in place, what I call the matrix of control, way before Barak's seemingly generous offer. So the misconception is this: territory. The idea is, if somehow the Palestinians get 22%, it doesn't matter what 22%. In other words, for example, we keep Jerusalem. Don't forget, Jerusalem has been annexed to Israel. It's not being negotiated. It's not a part of the generous offer. We keep Jerusalem and Latrun. We keep the Jordan Valley, which Israel sees as a security border. We certainly keep the settlement blocks. That was, you know, Barak defined the settlement blocks as Israel's bottom line in terms of territory that it had to. And it, you know, until today, you'll hear Israel say, we can build in the settlement blocks because that's anyway going to be a part of Israel. That's already agreed. You know, so that's taken out of negotiations. So then the Palestinians get these cantons. So then Israel says, okay, you know, we'll give you a little bit of land down here in the Negev. Or we'll do a territorial swap. This is one of the most dangerous things. Because in this corner, in this corner is where you get the highest concentration of Palestinian citizens of Israel. You know, probably 500,000 live in what's called, if not more, live in what's called the triangle. So Israel's saying, okay, we'll give the triangle to the Palestinian state. And that thickens it, they give the 22%. And by the way, we also get rid of 500,000 or more Arabs. You know, so Israel's willing to give away its own citizens to another country. So that this is the whole discussion is around territory. And that's the two-state idea. So somehow, if they get 22%, that's fine. Well, think of it, this is a great analogy. Think of this as a prison in terms of territory. If you go to the Illinois Prison Authority and you say, I'd like to see the blueprint of a new prison that you're building. Okay, and they take it out of the drawer and lay it out for you. If you look at that blueprint, it looks like the prisoners own the place. They have 95% of the territory, right? They've got the cell areas, they've got the cafeteria, the work areas, the exercise yard, the visiting area. That's all for the prisoners. And all the prison guards have is 5%. If it's a minimal prison, they probably have 1%. The walls around, that's not much of a percent. Today you've got in prisons these platinum, very thin bars. That's 0%. A few locked doors, and you've got a prison. You see, so the whole idea of just getting territory without dealing with control is what's mistaken. You've got to look at every plan and say, I mean, if it's a two-state plan, and no plan can do this, is it going to give, you know, you have the CVS pharmacies. Think of CVS. Control, viability, sovereignty. If you look at any plan, Oslo, the roadmap, any plan you hear, does it really, really remove Israeli control? Or is it like a prison with a lot of territory? Does it really give Palestinians economic viability? And does it really give them sovereignty? CVS. And that's the filter through which you can evaluate whether plans really work. The second question, briefly, which was, remind me.
The question is whether Israel is engaged in what it's engaged in Gaza because of...
Ah, that's right, that's right, yeah. That's right. Look, the whole thing is not just Gaza. In general, this whole idea of terrorism. You know, in a settler colonial... And again, that's why it's so important. I don't want to give a lecture and be theoretical and stuff, but a settler colonial discourse and analysis is really important because that's what reveals the political logic. Well, in a settler colonial, if you have a unilateral settler colonial process that's exclusive, in which the indigenous have no part, what happens when they resist? Their resistance is not political, because they have no political standing. Their resistance can only be interpreted and only can be viewed as being criminal. Because we're a peaceful population. We're Jews, in this case, coming back to our land. We want to farm. We want to make Jerusalem a beautiful city. We want the desert to bloom. You know, we're not against anybody. We're just coming home. And here are these criminals, these Arabs, that are fighting us for no reason. Or because we're Jews. You know, then that kicks in. Because you can't, if you don't give and can't give political legitimacy to Palestinians as a people with rights who are resisting displacement and the taking of their lands, then the only way to interpret what they're doing is in a criminal way. And that feeds into terrorism. And in general, terrorism works, it's another global concept. Because terrorism is only applied to non-state actors, not the states. Hitler, take the ultimate example, Hitler, for all the people he killed, has never been characterized as a terrorist. Why? Because he was the head of a state. Now, he might be a bad guy and a dictator and everything else, but states have a legitimate monopoly over the use of force, even if it's not done the right way. So only non-state actors, which are Palestinian groups or Global South people or anybody resisting the system, only they can be terrorists. You see, and so what it does is it demonizes and criminalizes non-state actors and leaves states off the hook. There's a very interesting book called Death by Government by a fellow named Rummel, Rummel, who is a political scientist in Hawaii. He's got a whole website, although he died a few years ago, but he still has a website. And he, in his book, he documents that over the whole course of the 20th century, he estimates about 170,000 innocent people were killed by what we would call terrorists, non-state actors, which is a lot of people. But over the course of the 20th century, up to 350 million innocent people were killed by states. You know, so if you actually take terrorism to mean the killing of innocent people, states are much more culpable than all these groups that we call terrorist groups, right? Except that term doesn't apply to them, and so they have a certain legitimacy. So, you know, this is part of global Palestine. Getting into this issue and unraveling it and finding the language it's used and the strategies and how it's constructed and, you know, really reveals, in a sense, what I'm saying in my book is that Israel over Palestine is a microcosm of the global north over the global south. And in fact, Israel not only is exporting technologies and what we call a security state and other things like that abroad, but Israel exports a language. Hasbara, Israeli Hasbara or PR, gets right into the American discourse and global discourse. As a matter of fact, there's a guy named Fred Luntz, who is one of the forgers of Israeli Hasbara, who's a forger of the Republican Hezbollah. He's a Republican strategist that uses that. He has a whole book about language you should use presenting Israel, and then he trains Republicans in the same thing. So, you know, what this reveals is, in a sense, a global situation that we're in. We have to fight not only injustice and governments and settler colonialism and other colonialisms and all everything we're fighting, but we have to try to deal with the language. They're very sophisticated. The language they use, and you know, they use very, very sophisticated methods. And I think that that we have to learn, not only in terms of Palestine, but in terms of the rest of the world, how to cope with those mechanisms.
Thank you.